May it please the court, my name is Helen Sigmund, registration number 13019, and I represent the appellant co-petitioner husband in this matter. This case involves a marital agreement that was upheld by the trial court but then not enforced. In this case, the wife has not challenged the prenuptial agreement in her answer brief, nor has she cited any cases that involve prenuptial agreements.
Listen, I need to stop you right there for a preliminary question. I understand that the prenuptial agreement was attached to the opening brief.
Yes.
It was requested, it was designated for inclusion in the record on appeal, but it was not transmitted to us as part of the record. Is that correct?
As I reviewed the CD that I received, it was not on there. My packet, we package our exhibits, and I think that clerk neglected to, she copied the first packet cover sheet, but didn't include any of the exhibits.
Okay, now here's my problem. Rule 10E certainly allows for you to file a motion to correct the record if it's designated and then is omitted from the record by error or accident. But that wasn't done here, and so you've merely just attached the motion or the agreement, which is, and it's not part of the record. So I'm wondering how it is that we can consider it now. Or are you saying that what you are doing in effect is now moving orally for,
yes,
for some, that's what you're doing?
I would move orally for the motion.
All right, okay.
I was not aware of that being an issue, Your Honor. When I raised the issue, I thought it had been corrected, but if it hasn't, I would move orally for,
okay,
the
motion. Okay, and we will ask your colleague here about her position on that. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing that point up, Your Honor. The wife has not challenged the prenup in her answer brief, nor has she cited any cases that involve a prenuptial agreement. I will give the court a grant that this is a very unusual case, and it involves an 84-year-old man marrying a 64-year-old woman. And in their brief two-year marriage, they purchase two second homes, and he also suffers right prior to the final hearing, he suffered a heart attack and had double pneumonia and a ruptured colon. So that caused some problems, Your Honor, and I think it caused the problem in the prenup, and I did attach it to my brief, and I am arguing from it. On page 3 of the prenup, it clearly states that Ms. Blevins now should not be entitled to any use of Mr. Miller's, the husband's, earnings or retirement monies, anything that he's identified in the separation agreement. At 84, all of his holdings were separate property. There is nothing here that wasn't his separate property. And what's happened is they have these two homes. They purchased this Texas home in June of 2008, and then we have the real estate collapse. And I don't think people anticipated, real estate falling as much as it did, but it did. And in this case, it clearly states in the agreement that any separate property is awarded to that property, and any joint property is to be valued and split in half. So our basic concern in this case is the court's requirement that husband indemnify wife for this Texas home on which she had to have been aware that it was being foreclosed upon.
So let me stop you a minute. The court should have looked at the Texas home and just, whatever value it may have had, split it right in half.
That's exactly right. Not to require, the court should not have required indemnification. There was a contract on the party's Arizona home. As I said, they had two second homes. There was a contract for that which anticipated some slight benefit. And so the court, I think, looked at the two parties' financial situations and tried to reform the party's prenuptial agreement.
Trying to reach an equitable as opposed to an equal division.
Exactly. And this agreement clearly required an equal division. And as we know from the Fife case, the prenuptial agreements are to be enforced as contracts. So the court trying to, you know, give some help to the wife here, tries to reform and says, well, husband's better able to pay for this Texas home. That was totally inappropriate in view of the fact that she had upheld and reviewed the contract, reviewed this prenuptial agreement, and found it to be conscionable and followed the Eichler standard. And I will admit that I made a cite in my Eichler citation. It is P3rd, not P2nd. But it had, the court did take the time to review this agreement and upheld it under the Eichler as being fair and not unconscionable. And in this case, the wife not only testified that she had called the Texas mortgage company 2 days prior to our final hearing on September 30th, she introduced Exhibit 4, which said that there was a balance of $2,000 that needed to be paid. 3 months hadn't been paid, but then said, you know, she couldn't afford to do this, she couldn't afford to pay this. But that's not relevant when you have a contract. And you also have a situation where they bought these two homes. Yes, she contributed to the down payment on the Texas home. That was across from her daughter, so that was the home she wanted. Husband never liked it. He goes to Arizona, buys another home, and I don't know whether it was because of Arizona community property laws or whatever. Her name's on it. She makes no contribution to that home, and I don't think there's any evidence that she made any payments on either home. She obviously had an equal responsibility for making those homes. Payments, those mortgage payments, but she never did.
Let me just clarify a really basic point here. So we understand that at least at the time the property is divided here, that the Arizona home is potentially going to be worth slightly more than, it has some positive value, correct. And that the Texas home has some net negative value.
Exactly.
And so your position is that just pursuant to the agreement, the court was required to split the positive value and split the negative value and assign each party.
Yes.
Okay, I understand that. Thank you.
Yes. And then we get into why taking this $4,000 from a bank account that she was cross-examined on. What happened was husband has this ruptured colon, heart attack. He's in the hospital. His granddaughter...
Before you get into that, could I go back to the Texas house? I still have a question about that. I mean, I don't know what the status is now, but let's assume for the sake of argument that we agree with your position on that house, and it's in foreclosure, and who knows who owns the house at this point. It's been some time. What should the judge do?
There's some obvious deficiency. There's some obvious deficiency to this Texas home, and because appeals take time, it's my understanding the Arizona contract fell through as well.
Okay.
So we really have two homes that are in default, and there's deficiencies on both homes. And it's the indemnification requirement that's unreasonable in this case. So, yes, this court should send this back, and there's no need for every trial court to order indemnification for every property division, especially in the case where there is a prenuptial agreement that says you take equal responsibility for debts. So if we go to the van, the wife takes out this $4,000 from this account that was labeled a joint account, but which she admitted she really put no money in. In fact, that was the account that went to pay the automatic mortgage payments for the Texas home. So when husband found out that wife had taken that money out, he closes the account, and that's when these payments quit being made. And so there are 3 months, is shown by Exhibit 4, in which no payments are made. And because of this, you know, I think that's kind of what the golden goose, right? You kill the golden goose and husband suddenly doesn't have it. But that $4,000 that wife took out should be used as an offset to the $3,000 $500, the figure that the court ordered husband to pay wife for the van. The court can't just say, oh, well, that she took that money, it was in a joint account, that doesn't count. Because wife didn't use that money to promote any marital asset, right? She didn't pay any mortgage payments for the Texas home. She didn't pay any mortgage payments for the Arizona home. So she should not be able to keep that $4,000 and then reap this benefit for the $3,500 on the van, in addition to being indemnified. And I would reserve the balance of my time.
Sure.
If it may please the court, Melanie Merritt, bar number 28097. I'm here for Sandra Miller, the appellee. We would state that there is basically two issues in this case, whether or not the court abused its discretion. Am I talking really softly?
Oh, yeah, you have, but could you address, take up this preliminary question about the prenuptial agreement that's attached to the opening brief. I guess I would like your position on this oral motion to supplement. I gather there's no real question about the accuracy of this and that you've had it for a long time. So do you agree that it should be added to the record?
I do, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And I guess that goes to one of the things that I'm going to address. The appellant would like us to say there's a separation agreement out there we want enforced. But in this instance, we don't want it enforced. And I'll give you examples of that. The house, there are two houses. The court, the trial court, clearly looked at the financial statements of both parties, noted that neither party wanted the houses, neither party presented much evidence on the equity in the houses, but there was $500 or so. The appellee says equity in the Texas home. The appellant declines that and says, no, the Arizona house has $500 or so equity in it, but they argue at the trial court level, there's no equity. So by splitting the houses, the court didn't abuse its discretion. It upheld the separation agreement. It said, fine.
How do we know that unless we know the value of some kind, the debt, the amount of debt on one side, the amount of debt on the other side?
The trial court addressed that in their order. It was presented in the financial affidavits of what was owed on the houses. I believe both of them were somewhere near $89,000, $90,000, and then what was left owed on them. Both of those were in the financials, and the court, in its final ruling, addressed that there was as minimal equity, if any equity, in either house, but neither party presented much evidence on the equity.
So your position here is that the court did not, in effect, try to achieve an equitable division. It, based on the evidence before it, it simply divided the property equally.
No, mine is that it divided it equitably and equally because they were about the same value. The equity in them was about the same.
How about the requirement that husband be required to indemnify wife regarding the Texas property?
Public policy in the case I cited, and I believe that was Jordanson, says that public policy says indemnification clause are good. If a person defaults on a marital obligation after the court has ordered him to accommodate that marital obligation, then public policy says we should go and indemnify that person for the default on that obligation.
Under normal circumstances, the court certainly could do that, but here we have this premarital agreement. Does that in any way affect the court's ability to rule if it's trying to follow the agreement?
I don't believe so, and I'll tell you why. Public policy. If, as in this case, husband, and let's go into the assets. The appellant is claiming that the funds are coming from separate property to pay the marital debt, and that's a taking of separate property. The court did not divide the annuity or the pension account. The court said the marital agreement says that's yours, it's yours. And then they said, and marital debt, which is included in the marital division of property, according to Faulkner, they divided that. It went with the houses because there was hardly any difference in the equity in the houses and what was owed on them. So that went. Now I have to think for a minute. With that, they try to put everybody back in position. You never can get them back to the position they were in. But they try to put them back in that position. Now, if either party defaults, it wasn't one-sided. If he defaults, she has to indemnify him. And if she defaults, she has to indemnify him. If he defaults, he has to indemnify her. Public policy says you just can't. He went and paid, he contracted for these houses with his income to pay them. My client only made about $800 a month off of Social Security at the time. She was not working. He made $4,000 and something off of his income from his retirement account. And I say income. It is taxed as income. His annuities and pension may be a separate property, but the income coming in is taxed just as income. The appellant's argument that that is a taking of separate property because he has to use that money to pay those debts fails. It would void public policy. Every person on retirement could go contract to buy a house during a marriage, divorce, and say, I have no responsibility for that debt because it would be a taking of personal property because I have to pay it with
the income. But isn't this a little simpler than what you're saying? This has a prenuptial agreement.
It does. And there's nothing in the
And there's public policy. The legislature said parties can do that.
They can. But it does not take into account what happens if the one party, the appellant wanted the court to sanction a foreclosure. Everybody walk away from the houses, don't do anything with it. What is the public policy there? We already.
But why would public policy govern if the terms of the contract, as it were, here are clear?
The contracts don't address, I'm going to walk away from some property and let it go into foreclosure and there's going to be a default. The separation agreement addresses how do we divide property? We divide it equally. Okay, there's a house that has $500 equity. There's another house that may or may not have $500 equity. Each of you take the houses, pay the debts, equal. So I think the public policy to uphold the separation agreement, I'm saying the separation or the prenuptial agreement should be upheld. And it was, sort of. As I said, the appellant wants it upheld in some aspects, and void in others. When she argues about the $4,000 removed from the bank account, it was a joint bank account. Testimony in the transcript says it had between $20,000 and $40,000 in it at time. $4,000 she took by the prenuptial agreement. Whenever something was titled in both parties' name, it became divisible by half. $4,000 were taken. The court addressed that. The court addressed that in regards to attorney fees also. But for that part, she doesn't want this prenuptial agreement upheld. She wants it voided for that account. The car, the court found that the van was worth $7,100, irrespective of who put what in. The prenuptial agreement says, doesn't matter who put what in. If it's titled in both names, it's divisible by two. Court found that it was worth $7,100. They split the money. Each $3,550 to one, $3,550 to the other. They split the money, just like the prenuptial. The appellant doesn't like that. In that aspect, they don't want the separation or the prenuptial agreement upheld.
Following your argument, and so without regard to fault, without regard to contribution, the value of the van is divided in half. Why isn't it the case that without regard to fault, without regard to contribution, the debt on the Texas house should be split in half?
But there's the debt on the Arizona house, too.
And that too, right?
Basically, they were split in half because the court said, I'm separating these parties. I'm separating these parties per the separation agreement. We have two houses. We have two debts. They're, for all intents and purposes, the same. You take one, you take other. Now, why did my client get the Arizona house? Because Mr. Miller, while he purchased the house with money he was getting, and they were paying it with the money he was getting, because my client only had $800 a month coming in, he was also rented, he had total control over the Texas house. He put that house for sale with a realtor. He chose the sale price. It's in the transcript. He changed the rental price. He rented it to the realtor's daughter. Without my client knowing, he lowered the rent to the daughter below the price of the mortgage. Then he collected the mortgage bill and never paid the mortgage. He paid up the Arizona mortgage. He kept that current. He handled this. The appellant argues that he was ill and unable to care for himself, which is irrelevant to this issue here. He made a contract on an Arizona house with a lease to an option to purchase to make sure that rent was being, or that mortgage was being paid and that house was being taken care of. He just let the Texas house fall to the wayside, collected the rents, never made a payment on it. He knew that there was going to be a deficit because he was paying the rent or the mortgage, then he was collecting the rent and not paying the mortgage. He knew sooner or later it would be going into foreclosure. Ms. Sigmund misstates my client's testimony. She did not call. The day before our permanent orders hearing, she went online and got a printout that discovered the Texas house was $2,500 and some odd in default at that point. But Mr. Miller had the option to do that. He had total control. He knew he was receiving rent and not paying the rent. And the court, in its last, in its closing statements, he said, Mr. Miller knew the Texas house was not being paid. He was collecting rent on the Texas house. He rented the house to the realtor's daughter. He lowered the rent on the house below the mortgage to the realtor's daughter. He has been in total control, just like in Jorgensen, one of the cases I cited in my brief. He was in total control of that asset. It went into default due to his neglect to pay it.
Could I ask you about the attorney fees issue?
The attorney fees? We are requesting attorney fees. The court did not address that clearly in its orders.
And you're requesting it under 1410.119.
I am. I'm also requesting it under 13.1703. I believe that's the letter for sanctions. I think this is a frivolous lawsuit. The parties, the court did the, not.
I'm sorry.
Didn't
interrupt you.
Does
the prenuptial agreement address the question of attorney fees also?
It does address the attorney fees in the aspect of my taking of the reading of it in the aspect of estate planning. However, Eichler is very clear. Attorney fees are to be determined at the time they're enforced. Public policy again. I thought you went with that. Public
That's
policy
fine.
Again. It is, if you read Eichler, if they're unconscionable at the time of enforcement, the clause waiving attorney fees and maintenance is waived. At this point, we're asking for attorney fees. My client cannot afford this. She gets $800 Social Security. This was a frivolous lawsuit, so we would ask that they be awarded as sanctions, and we would ask that they be awarded just as a matter of 1410. She cannot afford this appeal. This appeal has dragged on to where we have houses in foreclosure. We have the Arizona house going into foreclosure. She cannot afford to do this. And the public policy is to put people on the same footing in a dissolution of marriage situation. And she's clearly not on the same footing at this rate. So we would ask that the trial court, their division of property be upheld. There is, it's a division of property. There's a bunch of red herrings in here saying, well, the retirement income is separate property and the trial court's taking it. They're not taking it. They're following Faulkner. You can use future income to pay marital debt. If we didn't do that, the results would be absurd. We would no longer need to file debts and divide debts because everybody say, oh, well, I have to pay it with my future income. And that's a taking of my personal property. That doesn't make any sense. Public policy, again, doesn't make any sense. They accrued marital debt. It needs to be paid for it together or not. Everybody ends up with some of it to pay out of their future earnings or whatever, because no one usually has a pocket of money to say, oh, I'm getting a divorce. Let me pay all this debt or all this debt. It's going to be paid out of future income. That argument is frivolous. It doesn't make any sense that you would say that. Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thanks.
This is not a frivolous appeal, and Ms. Merritt, I do appreciate her consenting to the admission of the prenuptial agreement, but with regard to her argument regarding the Texas home had $500 of equity according to husband's financial statement, that's actually a typo in Exhibit 4. Obviously contradicted that, which showed that $2,503 was past due.
Let me ask a different question. Is the amount of debt on each house approximately the same?
No, I don't think that's true.
What does the record show?
But the record showed that it was like $79,000 for the Arizona property, I think. It was like $89,000. I'd have to check on that. But regardless of whether the debt was about the same, this indemnification in the case that Ms. Merritt cited in her answer brief regarding indemnification was In Re the Marriage of Plush, at 881 P2nd 379. In that case, the trial court ordered indemnification, hold harmless language. It said to compensate wife for losses suffered as a result of husband's acts or omissions. In this case, the indemnification was not ordered for anything like that, but rather just because I think this magistrate thought everything should be indemnified. And in this case, for the prenup where they say the value is shared, obviously they're contemplating positive values. But in this case, and with 2008 and the economic real estate crash, there's no positive values here. They're both negative.
Did the magistrate value the homes or the debt on the homes?
The magistrate looked at the Exhibit 4. In Exhibit 4, it had original loan date, and it had original loan amount, and it had original appraisal amount. And she speculated that, oh, well, this original appraisal shows there might be some equity in here. So even though she was ordering husband to make this $2,500 payment immediately, she knew that there was no equity in it and that he'd have to be paying $2,500. Now, I will say that some of the mortgage monies were received by husband and there was confusion. And that's what we had these affidavits submitted to the court with a Rule 59 motion saying, not only did wife receive one of the mortgage payments, but we think wife talked to the Texas mortgage company and knew the property was in foreclosure, yet went to trial and said, you know, this is all that's owed. And I think she misrepresented that. She had signed the lease option for the Arizona home. So she's agreeing to the Arizona property being sold for what's owed on it. And she never made any.
Is there anything that would have kept husband from finding out what was going on with the Texas property?
I think the thing that kept him from finding that out was that he had had a heart attack, a ruptured
I know you were arguing that, but there's some evidence in the record, is there not, that he had contact with the banks there.
That's what was that. If you look at the address was not his address. He was living with his granddaughter, and she filed an affidavit saying she had not, she had talked to the mortgage company and that he didn't know the property was in foreclosure. He had gotten a call from the realtor who asked him whether it was in foreclosure, and he didn't even know, so he didn't think it was. I mean, he was 86 by this time.
Okay, let me ask you a different question. The argument for wife seems to be that the court actually followed the prenuptial agreement and divided everything in half. She gets Arizona, husband gets Texas. Assuming the debt is approximately equal and each party must indemnify the other for any liability on that debt, why doesn't that follow the contract?
Because it says, I don't think they are equal, but Andrew thing, assuming they are, and I think reality has shown that they aren't, but I think it says that each asset would be valued, and I don't think the court actually valued each asset here, but what the court did think was that the Arizona house would not have any liability in connection with it, and the court knew that the Texas home had liability, and the rent for the home was not sufficient to cover the full mortgage payment, and husband agreed that any mortgage money that he got through oversight that wasn't applied would be applied, but it wouldn't be enough to satisfy, would not be enough to satisfy the deficiency. And by the time husband sent the deficiency, they wouldn't even accept it.
Thank you. That concludes our arguments today in the case of the marriage of Miller. The court appreciates the argument of both counsel. The case will be deemed submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.